Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Deep Thoughts. Today we're going to talk about a subject that I get requested probably about every half year. And I've thought about doing this for quite a while. The main reason why I've delayed is that it doesn't interest me that much. However, I think I've now kind of thought it through a little bit on how to add something else to it. Yeah, we have all these things that go around civilization. All these stories and all these beliefs, and what's interesting is they're alluring enough to stay in the, I guess, in the current of man's consciousness, but what's fascinating is that there are so many that never get analyzed beyond just sort of an ankle-deep dive into the subject matter, and Bigfoot is one of those things. We have held this belief for so long, and even the deepest studies that I have seen by anthropologists who've made three-hour videos on this stuff, essentially filming a lecture, it's amazing how even in some of their most brilliant dives into this, and I'll try to repeat some of the ones that have really impressed me, no one goes back to the inception of what we're really insinuating by saying, if these things exist, I mean really exist, what would that mean? What would it mean for them to survive the annals of time? What would it mean for them to be out there right now? And what would it mean if we found them? Because, you know, we talk about aliens a lot on this show, and I feel like, well, that makes sense. An alien, if you go see the episode I made called Alien Promise, any of the alien episodes, there's a lot to the concept of an alien arriving, right? But Bigfoot, we're talking about maybe if all the cartoony Hollywood portrayals of Bigfoot are 100% correct, you've got this sort of tame, you know, guy from the Goonies. And you're going to somehow have, an afternoon lunch with them in the canyon or in the forest. So let's review sort of the pop culture version of the story. Then we'll try to dive down into the anthropological insinuations of his existence. Some of the imperative facts that they suggest. So at face value, there is this neat belief in sort of a ghostly character that lives in the woods and the forests of the United States of America and other similar terrains. I don't believe it's ever been sighted in a desert. It's always got some lush green, which, you know, considering how much we're shutting that shit down. You know, if you ever go in your attic and start moving stuff around, or you're deconstructing, doing a demo on a home or something, you'll bump into little nests, right, of things that you didn't know were there. Bumblebee nest, the wasp nest, you know, something else gross. And you'd think that with all the deforestation that's going on in the United States of America and abroad, that you bump right into a Bigfoot, you know, harem or something. No such claim, right? But the idea is that there's this massive population of hominid slash yeti species that are out there, and again, we'll go scientific in the next second here, but it's out there. They have this really super duper thick coat of fur on them, like a bear, but it almost seems like per capita of square footage on their body that they are more hairy than anything in the forest, besides perhaps like a dog. Whereas, you know, a bear actually, you know, has some shorter hair in the face region, thus allowing its contours to come out so we could see its eyes clearly, its nose clearly, its teeth. But every time we see anyone attempting to film or claim that they have filmed a Bigfoot, it is sort of that silly costume where the designer just kept putting, you know, werewolf face hair on it, to the point you look straight at it in the face and you can't make out any features. I've never seen any features, and I've seen quite a few of these. Of course, a lot of them have turned out to be hoaxes, but just at face value, you have individuals in the forest who come back and claim they filmed Bigfoot. Now, let's look at some of the sightings over the years. You know, you have the initial sightings were sort of extremely distant. I would say, you know, compared to a normal shot of someone you would take saying cheese, fairly good distance away, maybe a couple hundred yards. And they walk across some terrain, they give a little bit of a look, and they walk into the forest. And, you know, obviously with a little bit better equipment, you have individuals now analyzing every single frame of these Super 8, Super, you know, 16 cameras and insinuating that the pixel data means something more every year, right? You know, at first it was didn't mean anything. A lot of the tissue movement or the fur movement on the outside of the being. And now in the last 5 years or so, they're now saying, oh, that's subdermal muscle tissue, and see how it does indicate that this is a real leg of a giant beast, because, you know, you couldn't possibly fake such a thing in a costume. And, you know, in some perspectives, they seem very convincing. You're right. You know, a big guy inside of a hairy costume is going to look silly no matter how much he or she tries to imitate some sort of monkey, because we aren't monkeys. And unless you've, you know, were trained by, you know, some mime company in Paris, you're not going to have specific know-how about how that works, right? You know, that super convincing one in 1967, where, you know, a couple guys took a shot of this thing walking sort of through some driftwood area off a beach right into the some like stream coast, right into the forest. That's been the one that's lasted the longest. And then for several decades after that one particular moving shot, we had these still shots. Big creature walking in a particularly remote area of the world. And then we crossed into the 21st century. Now, all of a sudden, we have a new twist to the formula. We have, let's do it with infrared cameras. A lot of hunters, you know, put these cameras in the forest to kind of see what the movements are of whatever. Some of them are just, you know, forest commission people looking at what the traffic is population-wise of a particular animal to see if they need to do anything about it. But now we've got the cub. That's the new one. No, we got not only the Bigfoot, but we got her cub. Because they theorized the one in 67 was a female, you know, suggesting it had boobs and that kind of stuff. I think that's fairly interesting, because I think if a bunch of guys were to fake a Bigfoot sighting in 1967, the last thing they would say is, let's make it a chick. Right, it's not going to happen. But I look at that shot and, you know, and again, it's just sort of like looking at the moon and theorizing that every bump and nook and cranny up there is a space station. I didn't see any tits on this thing. But, you know, maybe I just don't know enough about Bigfoot taxidermy. Consequently, the name Bigfoot is sort of a weird evolution in chain of events in the late 19th century. You have a Native American named Chief Bigfoot, who I guess was notorious for trying to chase a grizzly bear in the area that was killing tons of wildlife. And they end up calling the bear Bigfoot after Chief Bigfoot. And then within 5 or 10 years, the first reportings of these giant Yeti things were being passed around campfires, and someone started calling it Bigfoot. But I guess they used to call it the hairy man or the Was it the Wild Man? Those are like the really old names for this thing. So I believe that we have seen in our own lifetime the evolution of the hoax. You know, in the last, what was it, like 10 years ago or so, there was the group in somewhere in the, you know, Midwest Ozarks area that said they had a Bigfoot in a refrigerator, in some freezer. And it went on for months and months, and they kept releasing photographs of this thing inside of a freezer, kind of revealing a little bit more and a little bit more, and eventually the police showed up or someone showed up and they had to admit it was a hoax, that they had bought a big costume and then filled it up. And it's a fun thing to go through that experience, because obviously, you know, it brings out the child in all of us who ever believed in magic. So for a little while you're like, ooh, wow, you know, there's this thing. And then the moral to the story is, you know, be careful about what you believe before you put some effort into it, right? So what's the scientific theory behind Bigfoot? Where does this species come from? Why do people remotely believe this stuff? Well, for a creationist, it doesn't go down at all. That would mean that God created this bizarre kind of pre-man, as if God has to, you know, he's all-knowing, but then he's got to beta test a few creatures beforehand, right? You know, for any of us that have sort of thought about, you know, the notion that God would just create man because God wanted man, there'd be no need for gorillas, chimpanzees, yetis. There'd be no need for anything that's sort of on our level of competitiveness in the food chain around here, right? There just wouldn't. But your common evolutionist, you know, will try to tell you that obviously man came from monkeys, but for some reason monkeys are still here. And, you know, if you really look at that association between the two, you have your anthropologists that will tell you that, you know, there's not a single bone in a man that's in a monkey. They just say that. They go, look, I know they look the same and they're arranged similarly, but when you really look at the actual detail of the bone, it is completely re-engineered to be better. Not necessarily stronger, but more efficient for converting energy calorie into actual motion. And I would argue, I'm not quite convinced. I mean, goddamn, a monkey can fly around a jungle like crazy, just using his four fingers on each hand before the thumb. But the idea is that there was this evolutionary chain, of course, and at some point there was a missing link, this dark period where we can't find any skulls that attach the monkey skull to a Homo sapien. And in that time, in that missing time, all the previous skulls seem to match. They just get a little bit bigger, the brain cavity gets a tiny bit bigger, but it's always per capita of the overall size of the skull. So it's just like taking it and zooming it up in 3D software as opposed to actually making the brain cavity larger. When you get to our human skull, it's completely re-engineered on virtually every level, and every single minute detail within the skull, it makes us who we are without the tiniest chamber change in the vocal, you know, nasal canal. We can't speak syllables without increasing the brain cavity in disproportion to the rest of the skull as compared to our predecessors in the monkey world. We don't have the visual cortex, the eyeballs, the ear, the hearing, the thought, all that good stuff. So there's really no correlation besides two eyes, a nose, a mouth, and two ears, and what we have with the monkey world. And scientists who aren't trying to, well, basically, any scientist that can think for themselves, all right, will agree. And that I've got this opinion really from them and certified by them that there is no real correlation between the two. The missing link is really indicative of, if you're God believer and a creation believer, that's when God came in and went, boom, Homo sapien. If you're more of an alien type person, that's when the aliens landed, spliced into indigenous life, took what was good, left what was bad, and made human being, maybe modeled after themselves. Outside of those two explanations, I have no explanation. There's a mystery as to why hundreds of millions, if not billions of years of our evolution is completely missing physically, right? And, you know, one of the assertions was that man went into the forest, went into the jungle, any vegetation spot. And then as every single evolutionary connection species between monkeys and man died in the forest, that they were consumed by the forest, consumed by the animals, and that's why there are no bones. The notion, okay, that monkeys lived in the desert is preposterous. So all the other skulls lasted in the same exact environments. There is no reason why some specific geographical location makes us all go away for several hundred million years while we get to Homo sapiens sapien, right? But where does that apply to Bigfoot? Well, Bigfoot is this other sort of mystery. We do have gigantic skulls, you know, that, again, I haven't seen a gorilla skull. I mean, I have seen a gorilla skull a couple times on, you know, online picture presentation stuff. But in terms of, you know, how the evolution goes from even the prehistoric monkey-like creatures up into what might be, you know, a gorilla, a chimpanzee, you know, I haven't had someone lay it out perfectly. But there is a bone trail of hominid yeti, a much larger skull version of the previous predecessors before the missing link. And it's big. Except while the human being was being re-engineered to be able to have all these capabilities vocally, the hominid didn't have any of that. It kept its sort of rhesus monkey interior canal, right? It's gorilla canal. It's, you know, chimpanzee canal. So it cannot articulate syllables as far as we know. At least these skulls couldn't do it. What it could do is howl. And I imagine that, you know, it's not like a piccolo can't bust your eardrums, but much larger apertures can make much larger sounds. So one of the things we're missing from all these sightings is a hearing. We don't hear these creatures howling. As far as I know, of course, there's plenty of campfire stories that say that's the case, but we're going to get into the photography of these things and the recording of these things, since cell phones have now all had HD cameras for over 10 years, right? Now, anthropologists are divided on Bigfoot, of course. Obviously, the majority don't want to be scrutinized any way, shape, or form, so they come out wildly against any belief in such a thing. Doesn't mean internally that they don't believe it. It just means overtly they're not willing to admit it, right? And there's a lot of people like that who have their own shows on YouTube, on their own shows on the internet. They believe, they just don't have the balls to admit it. But for the few that really, really believe in Bigfoot, they're torn between the sightings and the footprints that are supposedly been recorded by travelers, you know, footprints in mud that dries, footprints in snow. One of the first photographs ever taken was in the late 50s of what looks like a pretty silly footprint. And what's really silly about it is that they only ever take one photograph of one foot. They never take the whole path, like Danny in The Shining, right? They never have, like, the whole thing. And why don't you follow where the hell it's going? At least you could report to the authorities, yeah, I went up into that cave right there, and then the authorities could swoop in and see if it's real. Or the experts, right? And, you know, what's funny about it is that I don't think there's been a human being that hasn't stepped inside snow and realized that you can become an artist the second that you step inside snow. You can take your own footprint and add to it. You can draw in snow or make an angel in the snow. And so, you know, snow prints, eh. The one I saw was, you know, had a big pronounced big toe. It was just silly. It didn't match any of the other footprints I've ever seen to be claimed. So when the footprints don't match each other, right? We're talking about a species here that can mate with itself and procreate. And so someone said, you know, humans do have strange feet, but you know, you can get a small female footprint and a gigantic, you know, barbarian man footprint, and yeah, they're going to look way different. One's going to be a teeny tiny size 1, and the other one's going to be, you know, size 20. But the anatomical placement of bone structures, padding on the feet, will generally be fairly similar within a particular region, right? We use planes, cars, trains, and automobiles to travel around the world and cross mate, right? I mean, we have like a 5'1" Latin woman from North or South America fly up to Norway and have babies with a guy who's 7 feet tall, you know, who's a white guy, and their kids are going to be an interesting mix of the two, right? Probably extremely bad eyesight. But inside of the United States of America, your biggest species difference between a Bigfoot concept would be a Yeti spotted up in Washington State and a Yeti spotted in Florida. Yeah, you might get some pretty different strands there. But the anthropologists that I've listened to about the Bigfoot footprints have to do with the way that the footprint has been created chronologically. When you slow the footprint down in essentially milliseconds, thousandths of a second, their assertion, at least one gentleman's assertion, which I think was fairly well explained and fairly believable, was that if you were to build a footprint in some hard plaster, and then you were to take that footprint and you were to push it into the ground, you're not going to get an actuated footprint. Meaning all the different joints inside the bone structure in our feet are not going to be chronologically imprinted inside mud, right? Because what happens with the human being? Well, we have an arch, we've got a heel, we have the padding right before our toes. Our toes are all individually connected to objects. Your big toe is going to potentially hit the surface a little bit stronger than your little toe. And so there is a chronological science to the way a footprint's created when they look at real human being footprints, right? Or real creatures. So I saw a presentation once where a guy went through a bunch of footprints of so-called, you know, Yeti, Bigfoot imprints. And he called out some hoaxes. And again, what was funny about all these was that there was only one real good footprint. And the rest was all kind of weird. Like they didn't want to take the same mold. Like if you had fake feet, right? Made of rubber, made of other plaster, someone's hand carved something, and then when you push it into mud, it looks organic. And you kept using that mold over and over and over. You might have carved a hair, carved a mole, carved something that was temporary, and it's not going to look right 6 footprints down. And so they simply don't do it. They just do the one. And, you know, the other one, too, is that these footprint sightings where they take casts, this individual had actually done the casts himself on a couple occasions. But you have people doing casting and then bringing it to experts. And so in that realm, we're only dealing with a piece of artwork, really. You know, you don't have to prove you ever found it anywhere in the ground. But the gist of that example is that there are footprints out there that appear. Okay, and this is only if the science is correct. This guy, I forgot his name, but you know, he claimed that there was a whole division of scientific research that has analyzed the chronological creation of a footprint. And, you know, I haven't bumped anyone who's got that degree. So for me, it's like, oh, wow, that's really weird. I guess if that's true, that's pretty impressive. But he had found a couple footprints that he thought were very, very real. And a lot of it has to do with the way that the edge of the footprint will actually displace mud. And that because the epidermis, the skin, is stretching and and, you know, yielding to the bone and the muscle tissue underneath, that it's got a weird thing. And the first part of the foot that hits the ground up to the last part that hits the ground, there's a distinct difference in the way that the skin manipulates the mud. Sounds good, right? So the big question, after you look at some of the science, we've got bones that suggest that these things did exist in some realm. We have footprint experts. We have people that look at the movies and the photographs and say they're seeing subdermal muscle tissue, even breasts. And the story just keeps getting updated. And they say, well, why can't we find these things? I mean, seriously, it's one thing to say you can't find a small thing because they're small. Well, a weird species of ant, right? Imagine someone said, you know, I found this whole colony of ants, and instead of having two telescopic hexagonal eyes, they have these eye grids that they have. They had three. But they had one big one, big cycloptic ant. Its whole head was just nothing but an eyeball, and they seemed so much more intelligent, and we sat down and had coffee and talked about the birds. You know that finding that thing would be astronomically against, right? But finding a big, giant population of humanoid creatures that are standing upright anywhere, I mean, it seems like 7 feet is sort of the minimum height of these things. Seems hard to believe, doesn't it? They do say the world's a big place. And as I've cited in previous episodes that touch on this subject, the panda bear was something that was theorized to exist in the 1800s in Japan. Now, Japan has really rocky terrain in various places. Very formidable stuff. They built golf courses where they've had to like slice off the top of mountains to make flat spots to drive the ball to, right? With these death-defying bridges that put them together, right? But supposedly they searched for this thing for 70 years. Never found it until Teddy Roosevelt's child was over there exploring, walks inside of a hut, and sees the skin of a panda bear hanging on the inside of a hut. And he says, where, you know, take me to this creature. And they took him down to a waterfall, and sure enough, they're crawling all over the bamboo down there. Boom, it's discovered. 70 years of theorizing it, hundreds if not thousands of years of telling folk tales about it, and it exists. The unicorn was found. So has this been the case with Bigfoot? I mean, if the panda bear was discovered at the turn of the 20th century, are we just a few decades away from discovering Bigfoot? Well, let's keep track of the individuals that have devoted their lives to finding it and the individuals that seem to always find it. The people that seem to find it are just your average Joe. Some guy out there hunting, some guy out there fishing, some guy out there shooting. And he's in the woods. And the footage is always, always, always obfuscated by bushes and trees, except for the one in 1967. And there's a couple little photographs here and there with, you know, big giant looking man way far away on a vista edge, that sort of thing, taken by, like, you know, Boy Scout leader, you know, pedophiles or whatever. But we don't seem to be edging closer to getting a really good shot of these things, right? They don't seem to get any clearer. They seem to have the cub formula in there. And, you know, the interesting thing about the cub formula is that you would probably be coaxing in a child. Or, you know, on some weird extreme case, I guess you could say that someone could have a little bear with them. You know, good luck getting a bear away from its mother. But the hoax would have to take on, you know, some extra players in the reenactment. But I'll tell you what, in today's age, you know, I'm a little cynical about how difficult it would be to keep a child or keep a child quiet as after participating in something that might grow to be fairly famous, you know. We all remember the inflatable UFO that supposedly had a child in it. We all woke up that morning, went to work, probably like 2008, somewhere in there. We're all watching it on the news to see if the guy, and then eventually the boy admits he was hiding in the attic the entire time because his father was creating a stunt to make the money. I mean, the funny thing is you think of a child weighing at least 80 pounds inside of an inflatable balloon, and you're sitting there going, yeah, what fucking balloon could lift an 80-pound kid without being fairly large, right? But boy, everyone wanted to believe it, right? And I'm sitting there looking at this thing. I was at this breakfast cafe when it was going down. I'm sitting there the whole time. I'm telling everyone, it's like, there's no way that thing could hold up a child. I mean, that's maybe a baby, but not a like a 12-year-old kid, for Christ's sake. And sure enough, that was the case. With Bigfoot sightings, I'm not sure. But again, they're getting clever. They want to try to create organic excuses why you can't see the thing clearly. We've had a few billionaires publicly say they're going to find Bigfoot. And they're going to use infrared to find them, which I think is fantastic, right? Now, let's split that hair for a split second. Infrared definitely shows you where something is that's bearing heat inside of a forest floor, a jungle floor, whatever. Your problem is that for you to know what something is, you have to track two different things. There's a overall mass imprint, meaning how big is the blob in your infrared camera. You know, there's a difference between a moose and a mouse, right? And then you have to take a picture of the thing from such an angle that you have pattern recognition, meaning you're looking for a biped, two legs, two arms, a body, and then hopefully if you're finding them in their indigenous wildlife, there'll be some form of family, right? Now the thing is if this is some sort of humanoid, it would be and it were to be alone all the time, then it would the isolation property / attribute of this particular life form would be the most unique thing about it, because look at every other biped species that we have on Earth, right? Well, obviously human beings are extremely social. I mean, if there's any species that has isolation and is willing to sit, you know, by themselves and think, it's probably us. But your monkeys of all species, they're harem-based, they're pack animal-based, they do not sit out there on their own on a branch. Apes, same exact thing. Very pack animal, very harem-based, and they stay together. Most creatures of that ilk behave like that. Wolves are pack animals, lions are pack animals, you know. And so for the Yeti to be this isolationist is a really weird twist. Now, it is larger, so it is formidable. It will be able to survive confrontations, perhaps even with a grizzly bear. Who knows? I mean, grizzly bears are, if you stand them straight up, easily 10 feet tall in some cases, right? Polar bear is even bigger. But now think about the birthing process, okay? At some point, there has to be a mechanism by which this creature is going to go and procreate. And if they're walking around willy-nilly all by themselves, which is keeps the conspiracy hoax people in business, right? Then how does the male find the female? How does that work? There's so few of them that we can't just walk into the forest and find them, but somehow they're finding each other and screwing? I find that really hard to believe. There are migratory animals where you have penguins that will go off in different directions in the off season, and then they come back to, club bone a lot down in Antarctica, and they make whoopee and put it all together and have their kids, and somehow they can monogamously find their mate too, which is really wild. So if there was any migratory quality to this animal, to this hominid, and again, you have different species supposedly. And, you know, with all the folktales, then you would think that there would be literally sort of highways of broken branches and well-traveled paths with their migratory movements. And at some point, Okay, during that spawning season, they would be together in mass. Just think about the sex smell going through that forest. Then you have a birthing process. All right, well, you're going to be talking about a big, giant female carrying an infant in her womb for God knows how long. Human beings carry for 9 months. Well, it might be logical to assume that they might carry longer. 10 months, 12 months, longer. But during the birthing process, one thing is for certain. It is not going to be a pleasurable experience for the female. No birthing process ever is. Something gigantic coming out of your vagina, right? So I'm willing to bet that during some birthing process, you would have a lot of noise in the forest. If there is any sense of a spawning season, what we are suggesting is that over the course of perhaps a month or so, every female that's alive in this species is getting knocked up. And so they go out, and now you have sort of a bunch of female yetis out in the forest birthing and screaming and howling with you know, essentially a cannon for a skull that's going to be heard for miles. Let's just put it that way. Well, sometimes birthing processes go wrong, right? Sometimes animals die during birthing. Now, there's a big fucking stupid-ass rumor created by the Rockefeller Foundation, who essentially created the hospitals that we go to today, that it's very dangerous for you to have babies at your house. You must pay a hospital to do it. There's laws even passed now you can't do it in your house without permission, all this other horse shit. We have been procreating for years in jungles and deserts. And there ain't no problem with us having kids. This idea that females die during birthing process, like, you know, if you don't go to hospital, it's like they want you to believe that 2/3 of all females die giving birth. Obviously not. Right? Is it gooey and messy and bloody? Yeah, it is. What, you know, what irony that one of the most disgusting processes bears one of the most beautiful processes. You know, spiritually, you know, it's hard to get any higher than that. But now you have a Bigfoot female with a child. Okay. And this child is what? Is it a mare? Is it capable of walking in the first 60 seconds? Is it completely fully formed? Are its eyes open? Probably not. Probably not. Probably hairy. Probably got that going on. But then she's going to be lactating. She's going to be a little lethargic as she is trying to feed her offspring. And what does she feed them? You can survive on milk for a little while, I guess. But at some point, they need to eat what they're made out of, right? Go ask any wildlife, you know, expert how much food an elephant has to eat every single day just to stay alive. So the more body mass you have, the more meat you have to eat. You just do. It ain't a vegetarian, I guarantee you. So now you have potentially a slower moving female. A female that's most likely going to create a nest of some sort to just kind of take the edge off of, you know, the requirements to move around in the wilderness to survive, because she's got some stuff to take care of. A baby. So wouldn't that make them much easier to find? And where's the male? Does the male stay around? Does the male book? No one's ever claimed to have a male-female baby cub situation. But then again, you know, bears are the same way, right? I've never seen a male bear, a female bear, and a bunch of cubs. It's always, if you see a cub, run your ass off because the mama's really close by and she'll rip you to shreds. Which brings us to our next subject. Out of all of the videos that have been captured of these creatures, supposedly, and again, there's way more hoax photographs and videos that are revealed later to be such things than there are ever anything where someone sticks to their story, right? But why hasn't a Yeti, a Bigfoot, come right out of human being? And, you know, you could dream up a whole scenario where, you know, it bites a human, rips its arms off, punches it, does whatever it has to do, hit it with a big giant stick and squash a human being. Or at least come up like an elephant does in the safari and at least showboat and say, get back. Get back or I will fuck you up, right? There's none of that. These things are the most docile beings out there. Hell, maybe they are vegetarians. I guarantee you, if they were vegetarians, you would see the forest floor clean where they have to eat, right? The difference between like a jungle that bears a lot of fruit and a forest that just basically has a lot of trees is that you don't have a lot of edible vegetation, to my knowledge, in a forest, right? You can eat berries only for so long before you start shitting your guts out, right? And I bring you these YouTube ad sponsoring moments one at a time. So if we're trying to talk about strategically finding these things, and by the way, the billionaires never found these things. They never, ever found these things. And I remember watching at least a few 20-minute reels of infrared photography down on areas where there were so many sightings that, you know, it was like just a matter of going out and fishing and you get your own picture of Sasquatch, right? No one ever found anything. The more official the equipment becomes, it's almost as if they disappear. Now, I'm going to do a separate episode about giant human beings because I think that's a completely different thing, and I think that that's much more legitimate than the Yeti. Now, as a tiny little segue into that realm, as it relates to Bigfoot, the assertion with the giant humans, there's just a couple people trying to associate the two, and what they were saying, and they've got these weird photographs of these sort of, well, especially in Asia too, where the average height is pretty consistent for a particular region, you know, whatever the height is, because they intermingle with their own, you know, their small collection of families, they keep the height at a certain point. But you have these gigantic offspring that have been photographed. And one of them was given like a female name. She was a female and she was massive. She was somewhere 7 feet or above in this particular village. And someone had, they create this folktale story. And again, it may be true, who knows. But her relatives were all named as well. And they were basically saying any one point in time, this particular village in Asia had this Yeti gene pool that was going through. And some brave guy, you know, decided to mount this gigantic being and get it pregnant. So there is, and there are, excuse me, various tales that have been correlated with this sort of, it, you know, the reason why is that they call it a Yeti offspring is that it didn't have the vocal capability in its skull to speak. And so that suggests that even though there was somehow not a species barrier between this hominid offspring and a human being, meaning they could procreate, the sperm and the egg get along well, that obviously you're going to be rolling the dice to see how your skull manifests. And so, but they were saying that this being was very, very docile, very sweet. And, you know, they were giving her name like Susie or something like that, right? And there's photographs. I think it's kind of late 1800s, early 1900s, but you can't tell because in these remote areas in Asia, at the time they were 50 to 100 to 200 years back in a more agricultural revolution, or not even the revolution, but just more agricultural society. So you can't really tell unless you read the fine print. So what are the other options? Well, we have essentially two of the primary options, which is that these things are real and that they are very elusive. They somehow, through explanation, we will at some point find them like panda bears, and somehow the way that they traverse the world and hibernate and come out and what have you, it'll all be explained, right? They would probably most likely have to hibernate, I don't know, 4/5 out of the year, and they only come out 1/5 out of the year. Maybe they live in the ground or whatever, who knows? But again, a hairy body suggests a need to protect against the elements and to keep yourself warm during the winter season. So big, giant, super dense, hairy bodies are typically very active in the winter years of wherever they're discovered. And again, I'm not terribly familiar, nor am I going to get into the sort of offshoot, which is your more snow Yeti, you know, your white abominable snowman sort of thing, because it's all the same information, but simply put on to ice and put into the more Arctic territories. I think it becomes harder to believe in the Arctic world, even though they're white like a polar bear and you could look down and not see them. Infrared would pick them up, but their ability to harvest food would be pretty easy to find, because anything in an Arctic territory has to fish or dies. And so, especially a big, giant being like that. And we would definitely find a polar bear and a Yeti duking it out somewhere. Blood trails everywhere. And at some point, okay, the polar bear is going to kick its ass. It's going to eat a cub. It's going to pick on a youthful Yeti. And it's going to win, hands down. And we're going to find these skulls and these entrails all over the place. And we don't. And I think it's a little bit of a stretch, if not a massive stretch, to assume that every person that finds such a thing is in some conspiratorial science community that works for the Smithsonian. They're all trying to constantly keep everything from being discovered. I don't buy that for a second. So the other of the two is that it is all a hoax, and they're all fake. Every single one of them, and it's simply a campfire tale that has been massaged into reality. But because, you know, depending on how you view your reality, maybe you think it sucks, maybe you're really pissed off that magic isn't real, you hang on to this, and you know deep down inside you're not doing anyone any harm, you're just having fun, you know. It's funny too, because as a digression, if you go camping and you do have a fireplace that you can, or fire pit that you can build, or you can rent and turn on or whatever, and you're all sitting around with your family members, you wish you were a good storyteller and you had some spooky stories that no one had ever heard, that you could grip everyone around the fire. And for a moment, the suspension of disbelief is augmented by the fact that you're out in the wilderness, which is not where you natively live, typically, and you're entertaining and everyone's having an adrenaline rush and a dopamine rush, right, as a result of you recalling a story. But what are maybe some of the more outrageous possibilities? I'm just going to throw these out there, because I made a joke once a long time ago about this sort of assertion, and it never left me, but it was very interesting. This is just downright funny. We talk about the fact that with other disciplines in science that we study on this show, and Coast to Coast gets into it, and everyone gets into it on the internet, that the idea of interdimensional life is very interesting. Now, usually when you think of interdimensional life, we typically think of it in our brain as an interdimension of something more sophisticated, right? Because if something can find a way to traverse between realities, it's just basically shifting their ability to be seen or whatever. We always think of it as a UFO, an alien race, something with a fair amount of intelligence that has somehow figured out how to manipulate the dimensions of reality and move between them, right? So that our eyes can see them and theirs can see us, that sort of thing. But I made a joke once, which has stuck with me when it comes to Bigfoot, that, imagine a being that for whatever reason, you know, we talked about earlier about the migration for mating. You know, salmon swim back up river to their mating pits, and they mate and they go back down. That's how they live. Imagine a race, a primitive race, not completely primitive in the brain. They actually have a lot more brain power than we give them credit for, but because they have howling skulls, they can't articulate. Perhaps between them, they're more, mental telepathy sort of communication techniques. But what if their migration is interdimensional? They can move between dimensions. We don't think about that because they look like primitive beasts. But the reason why they can appear in our world, seem to harvest something that they want here, which I would only imagine would be food supply. Maybe if you were to take it to the latest incarnations of the conspiracy / hoax people, they're bringing their cubs here because perhaps it's safer here than where it is where they go. And they're not wearing a pit boy on their arm and, you know, teleporting to the Institute. They are, that's a Fallout joke for all you guys reference. They are organically going through some membrane and coming into our world. It's just something that's there. Perhaps their bodies and their frequencies can do it, and ours can't. Now, part of this is a good little sci-fi premise for anyone who's daring to go out there and write a Bigfoot movie. But honestly, unless it's a complete hoax, that would be my only real idea for how these things could constantly be sighted, but lack all those other elements and all those other very imperative behaviors that I just named in this episode, or described, right? The sad part is what would we do if we found them? Let's say we found them. What would happen then? We found the nest. There's some place that we've just overlooked. It's a particular cave, a catacomb of caves. If any of you haven't been to Missouri, if you, especially for those who haven't been to America yet, if you want to see something really mind-blowing, and I know that this geographical reality exists in other areas of the world, so I apologize for being so myopically American with my example here, but Missouri has some very interesting caves that are so dark, you can't see your hand in front of your face if the lights are off. Mark Twain integrated a lot of these caves and these little catacombs into his writings from Huckleberry Finn, right? But they're real. You know, I'm always talking about how I come from Kansas. The west side of Kansas is flat like the Truman Show. The east side of Kansas starts getting buckled and hilly. And, I mean, we have areas, we have, like, my family owns land that's so crazy bumpy. You would look at it from the highway and go, yeah, that looks like a pretty much a flat field that you could plow. You know, you plow it straight and then you can start growing stuff. And then when you get a 4x4 out there and you just try to drive across it, you realize you can't because it's just crazy. They're 3 foot, 4 foot ups and downs to the point the car will be upside down in a split second and you'll be stuck. But anyway, Missouri's got some pretty interesting areas. And once you see these catacombs and these crazy caves, there is a slight anthropological, I don't even know what the hell you would call the people that would study the living versions of these things, but you could think that they could have made their homes inside these caves. And again, my assertion is that I don't think they'd be so hairy, because I'm not sure there'd be a need for it. But, you know, caves are cold, so whatever. But the idea is, if they were ever found, what would America do? Let's just keep it here because we know how our press likes to exploit things. What would be the fleet of helicopters that'd be flying over these things, terrifying them? What would be the amount of, I don't know, military personnel that would move in to isolate them, perhaps even build some type of enclosure, and then maybe that kills them because they need to actually move in a much larger circle? You know, the Shoshone Indians were slaughtered in Utah by the Mormons because the Shoshone Indians were very nomadic. They moved in a gigantic loop according to the seasons. So when it was really cold, they went down towards Mexico border. And when it was very hot, they went up north in Utah, and they were always just in the best climate. And so when the settlers moved in, they cut the loop off, and then they were stuck in Utah in winter when they were never used to freezing their butts off. And so when the Mormons moved in and killed over 450 of these Shoshone Indians, it was like, you know, frozen wasps being sprayed by some bug killer. You're in hypothermia. What the hell are you going to do? So it might be that not discovering them, if you love them and if you like them and if you like the story of them and you like citing them every once in a while, probably acting as sort of like that guy in Indiana Jones 3, right? The guy that was trying to hit the tattoo on his chest, you know, the double cross on his chest. His whole thing was, you're not supposed to find the Holy Grail because you will screw up the balance of the world. And of course, that Templar at the end was like, I'm so fucking glad you're here. I can go relax in heaven. But we would rip them apart, wouldn't we? I've always thought zoos and water parks, God bless them, I think that they are the worst idea. I personally, I only have a few friends that have animals, that I think that they do exactly what needs to be done to have an animal. And a lot of people just get animals to appease the children for a few years until the children give a shit, don't give a shit about the animal, and then it just sits there suffering, right? Yes, it's fed. Yes, it's bathed there once in a while, has a place to sleep. But, you know, animals are extremely social beings. And you really need to devote... It's like having a baby for the rest of your life. They get a little bit smarter. And they get a little more calmer as they go. And they only live about between 8 and 15 years, right? But only those who really dedicate themselves, I think, do animals any justice. And I can't imagine that the masses that would rush in to see a Yeti, a Bigfoot, would be able to resist the idea of capturing one and putting it in captivity. And I'm sure that man would do that before learning anything about the Bigfoot, right? The big game hunters would move in and, you know, do it on behalf of some zoo somewhere in the world or some natural wildlife where I guess they could say, well, you know, it's got like 40 acres to mess around on, which wouldn't be enough. So in summary, I think that the thing that we can learn about Bigfoot is that we like to believe in things without really thinking anything through. And there's really nothing wrong with that, especially if we plan to do no harm. You know, it's just like, you know, I love it when a new Bigfoot story comes out and someone's doctored up some, you know, footage so I can see one and I can believe for at least that day or that week or that month that maybe they are real. Just as long as we have no intent to go capture them, to mess with their lives, to scare the crap out of them, to blow up their ecosystem, you know. You know, what really surprises me is that supposedly, again, they fall in the Ozarks. You know, I don't mean they fall in there, but they always are discovered in sort of the more foresty areas of the United States of America. What I don't understand is why they wouldn't be all over South America, you know, and I'm sure there's sightings down there that I'm unaware of, but think about the lush, lush forest and jungle down there where these things could just blow up population-wise. They could eat fruits, and there's all kinds of vegetation and rodents and big game that they could eat down there, and they never seem to make it down there. If the evolution, as put forth by anthropologists, is true, that after the missing link phase, which again is this very mysterious phase of our creation, the hominid survived. Of course, monkeys and apes survived too, but again, we were supposed to evolve from them, which doesn't make any sense. We're just that one renegade species. For those of you who don't know, potassium is one of the most naturally radioactive food supplies that we eat that are found in bananas. And one of the things I always thought was kind of interesting is that monkeys like bananas, right? And monkeys are always at the epitome of the evolutionary model, right? The picture of evolution is the monkey that, you know, stands upright over your millions of years and becomes man. And the idea is that radiation in minute amounts or lots of consumption, through lots of consumption, would be bombarding our DNA, creating mutations. And of course, the heavy mutations might, the deformed mutations, which would be cancerous, as long as the being doesn't drink Diet Coke and put a cell phone to its head, it's perhaps fighting off and excreting all of the tumorous cells, while the mutations that actually are in conjunction with survival of the fittest get the privilege of continuing to move up the chain of evolution, right? A little anecdote off to the side here. The day I learned that potassium was radioactive was when I was training some programmers from a nuclear power plant. And they came in and we had a whole spread for them at lunchtime because they were there for about a week learning from us on how to do this. And we had bananas on the table. And they go, oh, this is great. We get to eat bananas. And I looked at them funny like, well, what's the deal? And they go, well, we can't have bananas at work. And I said, why? And he goes, well, it's so radioactive that it sets off all the meters when we go inside. And so they don't let us eat bananas at work. And that's when I learned that potassium was very radioactive, which is funny. And again, we're not talking about bars of uranium or anything, but enough to set off sensors, which is pretty cool. And another little story is that I was watching some Border Patrol show on Netflix, kind of learning about how customs works, which is actually pretty fascinating. And they had a woman that drove through the turnstile, and she set off a radioactive meter that, you know, senses whether or not someone's bringing in some sort of radioactive material for perhaps a dirty bomb. And they pull her into the lobby of this customs check-in place, and they put a Geiger counter on her, and she's setting off the Geiger counter. Took all of her, you know, main heavy garments off, like her winter coat and that kind of stuff, so they could see she's just wearing normal blouse and whatever pants. And she goes, oh, you know, I've had an isotope inserted, injected into my chest to see, you know, to find clogs and stuff in my arteries and that kind of stuff. So I just had that a couple days ago. And so that's how sensitive our sensors are, which is, for me, just utterly phenomenal. They could find a little tiny isotope. Now, what a crazy thing to do, right? Don't ever put that shit in your body. Maybe a dye, but not a freaking radioactive isotope. So anyway, I hope you feel me. I hope this was entertaining for you guys. For those of you who wanted me to cover Bigfoot, it's been on my mind for 2 seasons straight, and I just couldn't figure out a way to do it, to add anything to it. But the more I thought about it, the more I had this frustration inside myself of going, come on, guys. There's a lot of things that aren't being addressed after hundreds of years of having seen these things, supposedly, and we're just not taking the conversation beyond, you know, tabloid magazine. So hopefully this did the trick. Anyway, deepthoughtsradio.com for all the feeds. As I always say, if you're on video, there's audio for your car. If you're on audio, there's video in case you're sitting at home and you want to stare at somebody smoke cigars in black and white. It's on iTunes, just in case you're an Apple person. And it's on vid.me in case you want to see season one unscrewed with by YouTube's copyright stuff. So the main thing is that season one, what I did was I opened every episode. Well, I shouldn't say every episode. I opened probably 2/3 of the episodes with some of my favorite music, and just to kind of jazz up the theme. Sometimes the music's perfectly on point where the name of the song is related to the subject I'm covering. But YouTube, you know, shits all over itself if you use 15 seconds of a song, while iTunes can play you a minute of the song without any problem. How does Apple have the right to play 1 minute of a song, but you can't do it on your videos? Stupid. If you're in Germany, I guarantee you, because Germany has a big problem with the honoring the copyrights of intellectual property in America for some weird reason, music companies just have elected to block any copyright use in Germany, because I guess, I don't know what the deal is, if Germany actually allows you to scrape music for free, or I don't know what the deal is, but if you're in Germany, and I know there's a couple of you out there, go to vid.me, look up Deep Thoughts Radio. You always got to put radio on the end, otherwise you're going to find Jack Handy videos. But anyway, thanks for joining. Take care of yourself and someone else, and I will see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.